I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Tim Westergren, founder of the internet radio company Pandora. Pandora personalizes the radio experience for listeners by playing songs that sound similar to the artist or song that a listener enters on their computer, iPhone, or in the car. Tim started Pandora in 2000, and the company made its first profit 10 years later at the end of 2009. Pandora went public in June 2011. Pandora is based on the Music Genome Project, a system that analyzes each song based on approximately 400 musical attributes, including harmony, instruments, or the nature of the artist's voice. Pandora has a team of musicologists who interpret each song and populate listeners' personalized radio stations with songs that they might like. Tim is a jazz pianist who has also played the clarinet, drums, and bassoon. Tim played in rock bands and composed music for movies prior to starting Pandora. Welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
You graduated from Stanford in 1988, and for the next 12 years, you had a career as a musician. What were your aspirations fresh out of college?
Well, I wanted to be a rock star. That was my dream when I graduated. I didn't really know how I was going to get there, but I really left college with a real passion for music.
So even though you were trained as a jazz pianist, you wanted to be a rock star.
Yeah, jazz was really how I learned sort of harmony and theory and the piano. But as a composer and as a performer, my passion has always been for sort of rock pop music.
And who were some of your favorite, you know, rock artists whom you wish to emulate or become?
Well, it's changed over time. It's certainly the Beatles are my taproot. I love just about everything they've done, and they've been a real inspiration for me. I was a big Steely Dan fan for a long time as well. Mm-hmm. But I like everything from, you know, Michael Jackson and Stevie Wonder to Fleetwood Mac to Ben Folds. Oscar Peterson's my favorite jazz musician. A pretty broad range of things.
Did you come from a house filled with music?
I came from a house full of tone-deaf people, so not a lot of musical background around me.
So how did your parents go about introducing you to the piano?
Well, it was pretty simple. I actually was living in France at the time, and I was interested in music. I took to it in school, and they just bought a piano for me. And I took some lessons from a blues pianist in Paris, and I really just took to it and started kind of teaching myself.
You had a nomadic childhood. You lived in France for a little while. Where else did you live, and what brought you to these places?
Yeah, well, I moved to France when I was 6. I lived there till I was 12, and then we moved to England, where I lived for 4 years, then went back to school in Michigan for a couple years before heading to California for college. And we moved because my dad was a businessman who worked mostly in North Africa and the Middle East and was always headquartered in Europe. He was in foods and pharmaceuticals.
You had this aspiration to become a rock star. What did you do logistically when you graduated from Stanford?
Well, the first couple of years, I actually really woodshed it as a piano player. I played piano 6-7 hours a day, really trying to hone my performing skills, and kind of gradually segued into playing with groups. So I was always a composer. I was always writing music, but I began kind of in my mid-20s playing live, and eventually I think poured most of my energy into bands, began to tour, did recordings, and really kind of lived out of a van for a while, did the whole sort of independent working musicians thing. It was certainly not something a lot of my friends and peers were doing. I think it was exciting and fun and interesting, but I think as the years went by, you certainly develop a growing sense of apprehension about whether it's going to lead anywhere.
And certainly graduating from Stanford, you could have become a consultant.
Yeah. This was not the most common career choice for my fellow graduates, for sure. And that lasted, gosh, until I was about 30. And then I kind of grew tired of the band dynamics, the sort of logistics of being one of many in a band, and became a film composer for a while.
How did you support yourself during this time? Did you make enough money composing these films or commercials?
I just about made a living doing that. I had a series of odd jobs in my 20s. I was a nanny for a while. I worked in administration at a medical school, a bunch of kind of very typical sort of musician gigs.
I don't think a nanny is a traditional musician gig for a guy.
That's true. It's not atypical for a musician. I think a lot of people are involved in that. But I did. I even played piano, you know, in hotel lobbies and things like that.
The idea for the Music Genome Project, which really is the infrastructure for Pandora, came out of your work as a composer for film. Can you describe that a little bit?
So there were really two inspirations for the genome. The genome itself definitely came from my experience as a film composer. And what happens when you're a film composer is your job is sort of twofold. One is to really be able to craft music for a certain effect, so to support picture, a scene or an emotion, a mood, whatnot. That's number one. And number two is to satisfy a director. So I got very accustomed to thinking about music and music taste in terms of musical attributes, which I think is something we all do to a greater or lesser degree. And one day I had this idea, because I'd gotten pretty good at figuring out what a director wanted. I actually would put them through kind of this musical interview, sort of the equivalent of a musical Myers-Briggs test, where I would play music for them and get their feedback and kind of glean from their answers what they wanted. And I realized that what I was doing was this genome in my head. And the idea just popped into my brain one day that, gosh, if I could codify this, write this all down, there might be a way for technology to marry it with technology to build a recommendation technology.
Incidentally, when was the Human Genome Project? Was it around this time? In 2000?
Well, I did some work actually at Stanford in the medical school for a while, and there was a lot of work being done on the human genome, so that was in my head too. But it was probably 5 years old at that point, maybe.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Tim Westergren, founder of the internet radio company Pandora. At what point did this become more than just an intellectual idea where you said, you know what, I think I might have a business here?
Well, the idea percolated in my head for a few months. My wife was very supportive of it. And then one day what happened was I shared the idea with a friend of mine who had already had sort of a successful entrepreneurial experience. And his name was John Kraft. And so he said, you know, why don't we just go ahead and do it? Let's just do it. And it sort of happened suddenly after that.
What part of your shift was the acknowledgement that you were not trending towards becoming, you know, John Williams, the famous, you know, film composer, versus, you know what, I'm really psyched about this project and I'm going to take agency and make it happen?
Well, I was making sort of slow and steady progress as a film composer. But like I think virtually every musical profession, it's very hard to know if you're headed towards a good, healthy, long-term career or not. And you know, you spend most of your time really grinding away, trying to build your business, and you kind of take two steps forward, one step back. I was encouraged by where it was going, but I didn't sort of see an obvious path to a career there. But I think what really caused me to make this shift was kind of a few things. One, I really thought the idea was a good one. And there was, at the time, a tremendous amount of excitement and energy on the web in the music space. And it held this incredible promise for, you know, for changing the music industry. And this idea fit right into it. And the second thing was, I was living in the Bay Area, so I was surrounded by this kind of almost, you know, irrational exuberance for entrepreneurship. So many people were starting businesses, and there was so much investment capital around looking to fund these businesses, that it was one of those windows where, you know, if you were ever going to do it, that was the time.
Can you sum up what the Music Genome Project is?
So the genome itself is a musical taxonomy. So it's a collection of attributes, and there are about 400, that collectively describe a song. So every dimension of a recording, whether it's melody, harmony, rhythm, form, instrumentation, the vocal performance, etc., each one of those aspects is broken down into a collection of attributes, kind of like musical primary colors. Mm-hmm. So the voice has about 15 attributes just dedicated to understanding what the voice sounds like. And the idea is that you can describe just about any piece of music along the same set of attributes by just giving them different scores. It's like musical DNA.
it's people, not computers, who are kind of behind the Music Genome Project, who are looking at a piece of music and taking 20 minutes per song and analyzing it. What was your thought behind using people versus, let's say, computers to make it happen?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it was our single biggest liability when we started, because everybody thought this was completely insane, that we'd have a team of people analyzing songs. And you're right, it can take upwards of 15, 20 minutes, as much as an hour and a half in the case of a symphony, to complete an analysis. And the reason we did it that way was that's really the only way to do it. Machines don't have the capability of extracting that kind of data from a sound file. And the other methods for, you know, connecting songs didn't solve what was for me the most important problem, which was how to surface the stuff you've never heard before. And that's kind of where my first experience as a performer came into play, because I was really interested in finding a way for technology to help the sort of working musician, you know, the person who wasn't on radio and didn't have a record deal. And the beauty of the genome is that it's completely blind to popularity. Mm-hmm. So we're just as adept at recommending a song from a garage band as we are from a hit artist.
I also feel like having people involved gives the Music Genome Project some heart or some subjective judgment in a way that, just having 400 criteria doesn't sound very, you know, warm and fuzzy.
Well, you know, we actually think about Pandora literally inside the company as a human being trying to figure out what you want and converse with you the same way a friend would, you know, that friend we all hope we have who knows your music taste and has this encyclopedic knowledge of music.
What is the background of the musicologists or the people, you know, behind the scenes who suggesting the music?
So they're all trained musicians. You need to have at least an undergraduate degree in music theory or equivalent to do this kind of analysis. Many of them have advanced degrees, and they're all essentially working musicians. This is their day job. They're in bands. Many of them teach. They perform. There are pianists and drummers and guitarists and people who play washboard and singers and, you know, everything in between.
It's kind of akin to the slow food movement, where it does take more time to collect data for each song, and you might have fewer songs in your library versus, you know, some of your competitors.
I like that that metaphor. It's the slow food of music.
Yeah.
Like that.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Tim Westergren, founder of the internet radio company Pandora. The company went public in June 2011. We'll hear more from Tim coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Tim Westergren, founder of the internet radio company Pandora. Pandora personalizes the radio experience for listeners by playing songs that sound similar to the artist or song that a listener enters on their computer, iPhone, or in the car. Tim started Pandora in 2000, and the company made its first profit 10 years later at the end of 2009. Pandora went public in June 2011. Tim is a jazz pianist who also has played the clarinet, drums, and bassoon. Tim played in rock bands and composed music for movies prior to starting Pandora. You mentioned before how capital was coming easily to entrepreneurs in the Bay Area, and that was one of the impetuses for, you know, maybe starting your own company. The culture felt right. How easily did capital come to you when you were first launching Pandora?
So the first round of financing came relatively quickly from a small group of angel investors. It was about $1.5 million that got us off the ground, and that lasted about a year, and then it got awfully tough. We spent a number of years unable to raise money and spent a good part of that working for free and had to kind of hang on until the sort of the valley rose again in 2004 to raise a big round of investment.
It wasn't until 2004 when Larry Marcus, who was at Walden Ventures, they invested $9 million in Pandora. Is there a story of that first meeting?
Yeah, well, Larry was certainly my knight in shining armor. He actually had been following our company for a number of years, had seen us several times. And I think he's a drummer, a musician, and someone who's got a real passion for music and the sort of digital music arena. He's an investor who has long wanted to be part of this space. I think he liked the idea, and he believed that the Music Genome Project was going to have its day. And I think he also appreciated the tenacity of the team.
How different was the company that you started? How different is it from the company that it's become? I mean, some things have changed. Like, you started out with a subscription-based revenue model. Now you make most of your capital from advertising, for example. What were some other changes made?
Yeah, well, I think that this company is kind of a combination of very much the same company it was when it started. I think, the core of Pandora remains the Music Genome Project and the mission of the company, which is to help people discover music and to help bands find their audiences, has really not changed since the beginning. The front end of that mission has changed dramatically, of course. We went from being sort of a technology provider in the early years, including building kiosks for record stores, into a consumer-facing website. And as you said, we started briefly as a subscription business only, and then within a matter of weeks offered a free version of Pandora. There remains a subscription option as well, but we now look at this business as being about free advertising support to consumers.
Your name also changed. You were Savage Beast Technologies. Where'd that come from?
It comes from a Froth poem, William Congreve poem, "Music Hath Charms to Soothe the Savage Beast." It's actually "to soothe the savage breast."
It's just a misspelling.
Yeah. That would have had different implications for the company.
How did you ultimately decide on Pandora?
Well, the name, the idea came from our CEO, Joe Kennedy. And we had been through kind of a very typical process of trying to find a name for the company. And when he suggested that name, it was one of those moments when we all said, that just sounds perfect. Mm-hmm. It's the story of Pandora is about this box that, she's so curious she can't help but open. And it's full of surprises. Granted, not the kind of surprises we're trying to provide people. But we love that she is insatiably curious and that you don't know what's going to come out of the box when you open it.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Tim Westergren, founder of the internet radio company Pandora. I want to switch gears a little bit. Songs on Pandora are suggested by not so much the wisdom of crowds or what the crowd thinks or what's most popular, but by the actual physical construct of a song. Why are you so opposed to, what's kind of popular these days, the wisdom of crowds and the community having a word in helping to form musical preferences?
So I wouldn't say that I'm opposed to it. And we actually do use our own version of collaborative filtering or kind of wisdom of the crowds in the way we interpret the thumbs up and thumbs down that people give us.
Uh-huh.
So when you thumb up or thumb down a song on Pandora, it curates your station in real time just for you. But we also collect the aggregate thumbs up and thumbs down for every song, for every station on which it plays. And we actually do use that now to help us shape stations. So
okay.
It is a piece of the puzzle. But I think the heart of your question around, why we approach this from the Music Genome Project standpoint is that, it's the one system that can really effectively surface stuff that you've never heard of before, that has no purchasing history or preference history that a collaborative filtering engine just can't grapple with. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is the seminal problem of music. It always has been. It's the problem for artists as well. And I was in and among these working musicians for a long time. And the problem is, how do you sort of get noticed? And the idea behind the Genome Project was it would be the one place that was truly a level playing field, where when you came into Pandora, once you were on the system, your chance of playing was really about your sound and nothing to do with how popular you were.
You do allow musicians who are not necessarily recognized by the public or don't have record labels to upload their music and to be offered on Pandora.
We encourage it. The only prerequisite. There are two prerequisites for playing on Pandora. One is that your music is good, and that's an editorial decision that we make. And the second one is it has to be available for sale on Amazon, and that's a function of kind of how we track content on Pandora through UPC codes, etc. But really, anybody can submit their music, and you do it online through a digital process. It all gets listened to, and we pick the best stuff, regardless of you know, is the band young or old or successful or not or on a label or not or cool or not? You know, that's just not a factor. And so you'll never see Pandora, you know, cop an attitude about music. And I think, you know, partly that comes from, you know, our own musical background. You know, as a musician myself, I know how hard it is to write good music, no matter what kind. So I have a real respect for just, you know, just about anything, whether it's the most kind of packaged pop tune or some very, very atonal modern classical music. I have a sense of what goes into it, and I think we have a profound respect for that.
Pandora may not have an attitude about, you know, about music, but certainly your listeners do. Do you have an example of some criticism that your listeners might have offered you because you're not part of this popularity contest?
We do get periodic objections from people about music that we play on their stations, for sure. Some people get very offended when we select certain artists and pair them with artists that they love, and they feel somehow insulted because they think that suggestion is uncool.
What's an example?
My favorite one is an example I got from someone who had heard a Celine Dion song on a Sarah McLachlan station. I will never forget, who was very upset about it and felt that it was just, you know, very uncool for us to pair those two. But after some back and forth, they kind of really looked past the sort of cultural label and realized, well, you know, musically it kind of makes sense and I like it. It took a while for them to acknowledge that, but it was a really happy ending. As a musician, nothing drives me crazier than music snobbery. You know, it's hard enough as it is for musicians to make a living, and the last thing that they need on top of everything is to deal with, you know, people who think once they've got some degree of commercial success, they've somehow sold out and aren't worthy anymore.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Tim Westergren, founder of the internet radio company Pandora. The company didn't make a profit until almost 2010. Can you talk to me about sort of the psychology of somebody who's working for 10 years and not making any money?
And I know it's pretty damaged. it's tired. Psychology is. I think that we had an incredible group of employees. I mean, really a remarkable group, both in terms of their sort of skills and talent, and also their tenacity and loyalty to the project. And I think that people never stopped believing in the basic idea. I think everyone who saw the music genome in operation and got to kind of play with the demo we had built thought it was really powerful, mm-hmm. and that we just had lousy timing, yeah. and needed to hang on long enough for it to see its day, which I think has borne out. But I think that when you go that long in such adversity, you know, there are a whole bunch of things that come into play, and probably more than anything, it's a sense of camaraderie and loyalty to each other as much as anything that keeps you going.
Is there a loneliness at all, especially being, the founder?
Yeah, probably the most challenging part of it is you don't know if and when it's going to ever end. And, you know, you're climbing a hill, but you just can never see the top, and you have no idea where it is. And that can be very discouraging. But I think when you're, if you're one of the leaders of that mission, you just don't have the choice. You know, you need to lead by example. You need to stay positive and respect the kind of sacrifice that people around you have made on your urging,
yeah.
For so long. So you don't, in some ways, you don't really have the luxury of dwelling on the downside.
Were there ever points in that 10-year period where you thought of doing something else?
Not really. I mean, there were many times when I was, you know, very afraid that this was all going to wind up as a big smoking hole in the ground, and that a lot of people were going to be let down. I lived with that fear for a long time, but never thought I'd just stop. You know?
And you had an experience in 2007 where you were on the verge of bankruptcy, but it did confirm the loyalty of your listeners when royalty rates for playing songs increased, I think it was by the Federal Royalty Board. And with the help of a lobbyist, you really got your users on board to write letters to Congress to have the prices lowered. Talk to me a little bit about the details of that experience.
Yeah, so we went through this period of time where a ruling from the Copyright Royalty Board, which is part of the Copyright Office in Washington, essentially broke our business and broke business for internet radio, period. And in order to sort of solve that, we turned to our listeners and organized a grassroots political campaign. It was essentially asking people to call their member of Congress and object, you know, protest this and demand some kind of relief. And it was an incredible, incredible outpouring of support. It was so large and so constant that Congress actually intervened to help solve the problem, which is a really rare thing.
Despite the fact that you weren't earning significant revenue or making a profit in those 10 years, you had fierce loyalty among your employees. What's an example of that?
Years ago, when we were in some of our lowest of lows, one of our engineers who had been with us for a number of years and had been, you know, working without salary for a long time, came up to Will, our then CTO, and said, "You know, I can't come to work tomorrow. I can't afford the BART ride into work. I just literally have no money left." And Will gave him $20 so he'd come in another day. I think he wound up figuring out a way to keep working, but we were scraping the bottom of the barrel for a while.
Pandora had a turning point in 2008 with the iPhone, and the number of users increased to 35,000 users a day because there was a Pandora app offered on the iPhone. Even though you had played a role in setting this up, were you yourself surprised by the meteoric rise of adoption?
Yeah, I think we were all pretty taken aback by the velocity of that, of the mobile growth, which continues unabated now. I think there were two parts of it that surprised us and pleased us. One was just the raw increase in growth, and it almost doubled our growth rate overnight. But I think probably more importantly, it redefined our category because people began taking these devices, these mobile devices, and listening to Pandora in lots of places other than the office, which is where we had principally been listened to. So, you know, they take it to the gym or plug it into their car dashboard or dock it at home and stream Pandora through their stereo system. And so it was almost like overnight we went from being a sort of an at-work desktop, you know, computer radio product to something more akin to radio writ large, and we were available anytime, anywhere. And that really is the story of Pandora right now. I mean, we are a 7-day-a-week, 24-hour-a-day habit.
Now Pandora is enjoying a successful period after 10 years of really a forced march. How does it feel for you? Like, do you have an example of what that feels like?
Yeah, so I frequently have sort of out-of-body experiences now where having been, you know, in such a troubled times for so long, I often sort of pinch myself, and that happens to me fairly frequently now. One in particular, I was at an event where Joe and I were being hosted by a Wall Street investment bank who was looking to win our business so that they could facilitate a big financing round that we were doing. So we were being courted by investors, essentially, and I was at this very fancy event in Las Vegas and sitting next to this buffet table holding a truffle-infused Kobe beef burger and a very expensive glass of red wine, wondering, you know, what the hell I was doing here. And it was like 11 o'clock at night, and I remember thinking that the clock was going to strike 12 and something weird was going to happen. I was going to wind up, you know, holding a Coke and a Big Mac or being back back at home sweating over the company's future. And I really did sometimes wonder if I was in a dream and was going to wake up. That happens a lot.
You are running a multi-million dollar business now. How much interaction do you have with your listeners?
So we actually decided from day one that we were going to take advantage of every opportunity to converse with people that were using Pandora, no matter what they had to say, whether it was a critique or a love letter and everything in between. And so we literally answer every single email that we get, and we get tens of thousands of them every month. And we have a team of people whose only job is just to do that. So we talk all the time with listeners.
What's the nature of some of those emails?
The emails range from you know, constructive criticism about the website to personal stories about having a baby born to Pandora, or, you know, someone who runs a funeral parlor and uses Pandora as a soundtrack, or, you know, bands people have discovered and gone to see, or, you know, ways they think we should improve the site. It's this whole, this incredible litany of advice, anecdotes, criticisms, hate mail, love letters. People send us brownies. People write music for us. It's incredible. A listener wrote in recently. Her father had just passed away, and in the sort of waning months of his life, when he was at the hospital, they had discovered Pandora and had introduced him to it, and it had apparently provided him a great amount of sort of relief and joy, you know, in the final months of his life. And he passed away listening to Pandora. And the listener wrote in just to sort of say thank you and to tell us what about this and how much it meant to her. And you know, because we know, you know, when someone dies, a hospital can give you the time of death. We were able to figure out what song was playing when he died, and we let her know what that was, and sent her a CD of it, and she played it at his funeral. That was a pretty humbling exchange to have with someone, but it's, you know, music is just such this powerful thing.
What was the song?
I think it was Vivaldi. I need to go look it up. I think it was Vivaldi.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
It's my distinct pleasure.
My guest has been Tim Westergren, founder of Pandora. Coming up, we'll meet Peter Thiel, co-founder of PayPal. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Peter Thiel, the co-founder and former CEO of PayPal, an online payment system where anyone with an email address can send money using their credit card or their bank account. In 2002, eBay bought PayPal for $1.5 billion. Welcome. Typically, it's striking to me how when entrepreneurs start out launching a company, the company they set out to launch looks a lot different from the company it becomes ultimately. And I was wondering if you are a victim to that type of evolution.
Well, we started the company in late 98, and we launched the initial PayPal product in the fall of 1999. And I would certainly say that the very first year that we went through a number of different cycles in terms of trying to figure out what we were going to do. We started with security technology on mobile devices, a wallet, sort of a mobile cell phone payment system. And then in the summer and early fall of 1999, we stumbled on this idea of linking money with email. And I think you're right. This is not an unusual kind of a way for things to develop, especially at the very early stages of the company.
My understanding was that you went out to venture capitalists initially to try to raise money for this encryption software called FieldLink. And you weren't being very successful in raising that money, so then you then decided, okay, well, let's start a company called Confinity, which does provide payment options using the internet.
Yes. Yeah, we went through several different names early on. There was a FieldLink, then there was Confinity, and then we actually hired a naming company, and they came up with 1,000 different names, and we liked PayPal the best. But yes, so we did iterate through a whole bunch of these things. I probably spoke with had maybe 100 separate meetings with venture capitalists or more in the course of 1999.
How did you meet your partner, Max Levchin? He's from the Ukraine, mm-hmm. and he was a programmer since he was about 10 years old. How did you and he come into contact initially?
I was giving a talk at Stanford in the summer of 98, and we talked afterwards and became friends, and basically he was trying to figure out how to start another company. He had already started a few of them back in college at University of Illinois. I was actually in the process of I was running a very small fund at the time and helping invest in various companies and things like that. We basically started working together. I was going to help him find a CEO, so I helped him interview various people. And then at the end of the process, he asked me to me to be the CEO, and I said, well, you know, I'll do this for a few months till we get somebody else, and it then evolved into a four-year commitment. It was quite an extraordinary time.
What was your lecture, by the way, about at Stanford?
It was related to international finance or something like that, which is my background had been in finance.
You spent quite a lot of time at Stanford. You went to undergrad at Stanford, and then you went to Stanford Law School. And while you were at Stanford College, you started the Stanford Review, which is a libertarian conservative paper.
I had gone to Stanford for 7 years in a row, and so there was a whole set of people from that area that I was, you know, pretty familiar with, and had worked together. And it was actually one of the great things when we started PayPal was there were a lot of people we were able to hire from out of that network.
You're talking about the importance of community, which you really found in Silicon Valley and in Stanford. But it's ironic to me because it seems like both you and Max, to some degree, had quite a nomadic upbringing. Can you tell me a little bit about where you're from and how you got to California ultimately?
I was born in Germany. My parents emigrated to the U.S. when I was about a year old. We lived in Africa for a few years. And so I ended up going to about 7 different elementary schools, which is kind of a lot. But from about junior high school on, we were living in Northern California. Max was born in the Ukraine, as you said, and his parents emigrated to the U.S. when he was 16 years old. And as Max liked to put it, they left in August of '91, which is in the weeks when the Soviet Union disappeared and was replaced by Russia. And so he was a citizen of no country.
What was the impetus for your family to move to the
U.S.? My dad was just doing some master's college work in the U.S., and so he was an engineer.
And what was your mom doing?
My mom had been working for an airline, but then basically became a homemaker when my brother and I were born. And, you know, our family was sort of extremely – all sorts of things about everyone's family that are kind of eccentric and strange and interesting. But I think we were very, very focused on education. I remember one anecdote when I was growing up in fifth grade. My mother concluded that we weren't doing enough work in school, and the teacher wasn't pushing us hard enough. So one day, you know, she showed up in my class and just sat in on the class all day to see what was going on. And the various kids were saying, "Oh, your mom's here." And, you know, anyway, so I think it was a good thing on the whole.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. And my guest today is Peter Thiel, the co-founder and former CEO of PayPal, an online payment system where anybody with an email address can send or receive money using credit card or their bank account. There's a quote about you. Actually, you said, every month you think you're going to die, and every other month you think you're going to take over the world. And this is an emblematic of your sort of roller coaster ride with PayPal.
I don't know if that's something you have at every single company. I think a lot of them do feel like that on the inside, where it is a bit of this extraordinary roller coaster. And I think PayPal was an extreme version of this, and it grew at a rate of about 5 to 7% a day, compounding daily. So when you compound math is very powerful. So, you know, by mid-November, we were up to about 1,000 people. By the end of 99, we were up to 12,000. By February 2nd of 2000, we were up to 100,000. By mid-April, we were up to 1 million.
How did you achieve that growth?
Well, we had some initial bonuses that we gave people to sign up. And then in January of 2000, we noticed that a lot of people were starting to use it on eBay. And so we developed a lot of features that were especially targeted for the eBay auction market, and you know, where you had both people who were both buyers and sellers, which meant that you'd send money to someone and they would turn around and they'd buy something from somebody else, and so it was naturally sort of this incredibly viral place where you got phenomenal growth rates. So that was sort of the good thing. The growth was just, you know, off the charts, and then of course there were competitive issues in that. Large parts of the payment industry, you know, are fairly – nothing ever changes. You have sort of Visa, MasterCard – the Visa, MasterCard duopoly saw as a threat. There were government regulatory questions about what the regulatory regime for this was. So this was a completely new payment system. So was it a bank? Was it a money transmitter? You know, what were we? And what regulatory box did we fall in? You know, our initial position was, well, we don't – we shouldn't be regulated at all because we don't fit into any of the boxes. And then eventually we pushed for being regulated as a money transmitter, similar to Western Union, which I think is probably the correct box. And of course, that's much less regulated than, say, a bank.
So let's dissect that a little more, this Western Union notion. Ironically, I feel like you are innovative in that you are actually using cash to move around from buyer to seller, whereas other companies who were innovating were using, you know, cyber cash or digicash or replacements for dollars.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you thought initially of using those cash replacements or from the inception you said, okay, no, we're going to be a little more old school and use actual cash.
One of the things that was a benefit when we got the company started in 99 was that there had been a whole slew of internet payment companies that had been started in the very first wave of internet companies back in 94, 95 that basically thought you were going to create this new electronic currency on the internet. And by 99, they had all sort of floundering for one reason or another. The biggest one was people were just not using them, and so you know, was the question was, you know, why give someone cyber cash? You know, we could give you a chicken, or we could give you, you know, Malaysian ringgit, or we could give you a U.S. dollar. And in fact, currency is a massive network phenomenon. And you know, the reason, you know, $100 bill is something that you would like to have is because there are other people who'd like to have that $100 bill. And so we're much better off giving you something which leverages off this already pre-existing currency network than trying to start a completely new one from scratch.
What did you do to incentivize people to adopt the service initially?
Well, we initially incentivized people by giving them referral bonuses.
Of how much?
It was about $10 if you signed up and $10 if you referred somebody else who signed up. So it was $20 per customer acquisition cost.
And were these all your friends initially?
It was initially the people at the company, and then they got other people to sign up and just rolled out in concentric circles like that. And you know, we initially were thinking, you know, this is crazy spending, giving people $20 to get them to sign up. But I realized that it was cheaper than all the alternatives.
How did you even have the cash initially to give $5, $10 per person? Where did you get that capital initially?
Well, we went through a whole series of venture capital financing rounds. Nokia was one of our early investors. We originally started with this sort of wireless small device focus.
How much did they invest?
They invested initially about $3 million. Then we had another financing round late 99. But then in early 2000, March 2000, as the service was taking off, we raised about $100 million, which turned out to be quite fortuitous timing. People, you know, they were lining up to write us checks because it was, you know, at the very peak of the boom.
But then that turned very quickly.
Yes.
So you were very lucky to get in and raise that money.
We closed the $100 million round on Friday, March 31st. And I remember it was the next Monday the market basically collapsed.
I want to go back to the competitive situation. There were a lot of companies that came and went before you came on board. But there was one competitor that stuck and that might have been a formidable foe for you guys, and that was X.com. What were they doing that made you pay attention to them?
There were a number of people who launched these services around the same time. And basically, Confinity, which had the PayPal service, and X.com were the two that had launched them at more or less identical times and were both growing very, very quickly. It was, you know, this ferocious competition. They were four blocks down the street from us in downtown Palo Alto.
Did you know them personally?
We didn't know them personally, but, you know, you sort of had, you know, you had a meeting every day where you were exhorting the engineers to, you know, work harder. And it's a somewhat disturbing account of human nature. I'd never seen people work as hard as, you know, when it was like, you know, the enemy is four blocks away. You know, both companies were spending money at an exponentially growing rate. You know, our customer base was growing exponentially. We also had exponentially growing burn rates. And it turned out we were both kind of freaked out about it. And so we finally decided in early March to do this 50-50 combination between the two companies, which had all sorts of challenges. So, you know, each company had about 60 people. You combined them into one company with 120. So it was like you hired all of a sudden 60 people that you hadn't interviewed. But it was worth it, if for no other reason than that it gave the company the necessary momentum to raise that $100 million in March of 2000 that then carried the combined company to profitability.
Whose decision was it to merge with X.com, or at least to start a conversation with X.com? Did you say one day, okay, I'm going to go down four blocks and knock on their door?
It was December 31st, 99. I was on the internet. I decided, well, I have to actually get an account on X.com to see what our competitor's doing. So I signed up the account, and 10 minutes later, the CEO from X.com called me up and said, oh, welcome to our service, and then suggested that we should maybe talk, and we ended up getting together and over the next few months figuring out a way to get the companies to work together.
I want to talk some more about the competitive situation, about the credit card companies and the banks. Why did they look you over initially?
I would say there were two things. One was that the whole thing happened incredibly quickly. So, you know, you have to realize nobody was expecting a new payment service to arise in, you know, a matter of months. And then I think the second part of it was that, you know, at the end of the day, we did not actually take away business from Visa or MasterCard. If anything, we expanded their business because we enabled people to use their credit cards in contexts where they'd never used credit cards before. And so, yes, some of the larger payment companies would have preferred to capture this market for themselves entirely. But at the same time, it was not as though there were people working at these companies whose jobs were being threatened if we were going to be successful, because this was just not a market they were in at all. It was a completely new market.
When you first met Max and you understood that he had a good computer programming acumen, how were you convinced that his technology and the technology that you were building was ironclad and was more secure than everybody else's? I mean, because that is really the heart of your business, is
yes,
to be able to transact in a very secure, protective way.
Well, there were several technology challenges. I mean, one was obviously to make the thing scalable so that you could serve millions of people and it wouldn't break. And Max had actually built some scalable systems before, so we're pretty confident on that score. The security piece was a bit trickier in that, you know, we didn't quite appreciate all the security challenges that we would have. In some ways, had we appreciated them, we might never have launched the company. And it's not like it's a single tech problem to solve. It's more like this iterative process of dealing with all kinds of different, very creative people in, you know, Russia and various other places trying to figure out new and improved ways to steal your money. You know, there were conventional ways you could have solved it by requiring, you know, enormous amounts of information about each customer before they used the service. But that would have just basically made the service unusable. So you have to sort of look at the fraud problem in the context of some of the other challenges, such as the convenience challenge. And so the real issue was this trade-off between how much fraud would we tolerate versus how inconvenient did we want to make it for customers.
That's right.
If there was no trade-off, you could have stopped the fraud pretty easily, but you would have pretty much shut down the service too. And this was actually one of the challenges a lot of the large banks had. They were very focused on the fraud problem, but they ended up creating services that were basically unusable. And I think that ended up being one of the most valuable technologies that actually was developed. It was certainly not what we thought was going to be the core technology, but it turned out to be a core competitive asset just because people were not willing to enter the business because they didn't understand the fraud problem.
We did talk before about eBay becoming a surprisingly good complement to PayPal. And after you went public in 2002, eBay bought you shortly thereafter. How long were you public before eBay bought you?
Well, we took the company public in February of 2002, and then eBay announced the acquisition in July, 5 months later, and it was completed in October towards the end of 2002. So it was you know, we had had conversations with eBay for a number of years before then. There clearly were enormous synergies. It was very difficult to know what the right value of it was. Once the company had been taken public, there was sort of a market valuation on it, and then it was much more straightforward at that point to negotiate a deal with eBay.
How much money did you raise in the public offering?
We raised about $70 million. We'd raised about $220 million in private capital beforehand.
I've heard before that you think that PayPal is linked to sort of international peace or prosperity. And I was wondering if you can narrow that down a little bit more. What do you mean by that?
That's megalomaniacal. You know, I think that if we can have a system in the world based on trade instead of people fighting each other, that would be sort of make for a much, much better world. And that's, you know, I'm very much in favor of free trade, free movement of capital, you know, trying to help people forge commercial relationships across all sorts of geographic and cultural barriers. And I thought that sort of the critical part of the infrastructure for that is a seamlessly functioning global payment system. The T-shirt slogan was PayPal was the new world currency. And I think that turned out, you know, we didn't quite live up to that, but I think to the extent we've pushed the envelope a little bit more in that direction, I think it has made the world a better place. I really do.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Awesome. Thank you very much for having me, Jesse.
My guest has been Peter Thiel, the former CEO and co-founder of PayPal. To learn more about the show, visit our website at fromscratchradio.org, where you can download a podcast on iTunes, follow us on Twitter, or join us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.